remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends.
Because we all know that silence is a voice of complicity, and I think there are many of us who do not want to be complicit in regressing some of the rights that we have worked so hard for over these many years.
This is Eric Galatis.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 28th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Michelle Coppola, Eric Tagadoff, Eric Galatis, Mike Moen, and Farah Siddiqui. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth with an interview on Street Root's recent coverage of Kaiser Permanente pharmacy workers voting to strike.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In-Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Aurora Biggers, a freelancer with Street Roots, about her new article. It's called KP to Outsource Union Work During Pending Pharmacy Strike. UCFW pharmacy workers filed numerous unfair labor practice claims against the healthcare giant since 2021, await new contract. Welcome to the show, Aurora.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. So your new article discusses unionized Kaiser pharmacy workers planning to go on strike along with other unionized employees of Kaiser. But let's start with this strike authorization. What is motivating the UCFW 555 pharmacy workers to go on strike?
Yeah, so since 2021, UFCW Local 555 has filed a number of unfair labor practice charges against Kaiser. Those charges include things like the Kaiser failing to provide information regarding bargaining and grievances, Kaiser attempting to directly bargain with workers instead of negotiating issues at the bargaining table, and also trying to dictate who the union elects as their shop stewards.
Can you explain what unfair labor practice charges entail and how it relates to the strike and the contract?
So an unfair labor practice charge is basically a complaint that workers could file, whether you're represented by a union or not, with the National Labor Relations Board, basically saying that your employer has violated some form of your, you know, labor rights. And these specific charges regarding, you know, what seems to be Kaiser trying to either not respond to the union or go over the union's head to deal directly with employees are both things that are considered illegal by the National Labor Relations Board and also the Federal Services Labor Management Relations Act, because they can impede bargaining if you are a union worker and you're in the middle of contract negotiations. They can also have what's called a chilling effect on workers who are maybe looking to organize, or they can also just create, unsafe or unhabitable work environments for workers. In this particular situation, these unfair labor practice charges that have racked up over the number of years, some, you know, have incurred during contract bargaining. Some of them are not necessarily related to contract bargaining, but they're something that the union says has continued to happen and is not stopping, regardless of the fact that they have filed these charges with the National Labor Relations Board. And it's reached a point where they've decided that it's necessary. Workers voted 99% in support of this strike. They've decided that it's necessary to go on strike to tell the company that these unfair labor practices have to stop. Now, separate from this, but, you know, related in the background, is these ongoing contract negotiations. So the contract, you know, is about to expire. And one of the primary issues that they're bargaining over is wages related to, and that's related to staffing levels, which are really common issues in the healthcare industry right now. So while the strike itself is not over, the contract negotiations, it's solely focused on these unfair labor practices. Reaching an agreement with Kaiser could be one way to avert the strike or even shorten it if they were to reach an agreement after the strike has already started.
So these workers are looking at a 3-week strike in October. What kind of an impact is that expected to have on Kaiser pharmacies and facilities?
The impact is, you know, poised to potentially be really considerable, as the bargaining unit is almost 400 workers. So almost 400 workers are preparing to go on strike, and this is at dozens and dozens of Kaiser facilities across the Portland metro area, down the I-5 corridor, and in Southwest Washington. You know, this is not just the pharmacy where you go to pick up your prescriptions. It's also the mixing labs. It's also the warehouses. It's the postal prescription service areas. So it would be a pretty significantly wide reach that would impact Kaiser. Now, Kaiser has said that they are planning to outsource this union work. So where these union workers would usually have work because they're going on strike, Kaiser has decided to outsource that work to local community pharmacies, which is something that is pretty unusual for large healthcare giants to do. And is also something that would be typically considered a form of strike-breaking activity, because they're replacing this union work with non-union workers.
What has been the union's reaction to that strategy or finding out about it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and certainly a question I have. I reached out to the union a few days ago, but have not received a response from them on what their perspective is on Kaiser choosing to outsource their labor. So that's to be determined, and we'll have to see. I know in a lot of spheres, I think people are used to seeing strikes happen and hearing the phrase of don't cross the picket line. UFCW is certainly really familiar with having strikes at grocery stores. That's one of the primary sectors that they unionize in. And that's definitely a situation where they, you know, would not support, most likely would not support the companies bringing in what's quote unquote scab workers to replace union work, and would also try to dissuade community members from shopping at those grocery stores during the strike. But it can be a little bit different in the healthcare industry. It's one of the reasons why they give an ample amount of time to notify the employer so the employer can make arrangements to ensure that, you know, the healthcare is able to be continued for patients. You know, in talking with UFCW, they certainly don't want patients to defer healthcare for the sake of, you know, not doing business with Kaiser. So, you know, we'll have to see what their perspective is on Kaiser choosing to outsource labor. But I do know that their main intention with the strike is not to cause any harm to patients, but simply to send a message to the company that says, hey, if you want to do this work, you're going to have to find another way to get it done without the union workers.
Well, earlier you mentioned contract negotiations and how those might factor into if a strike happens and how long it could happen. What are the things that workers are looking for in an agreement?
Yeah, one of the primary issues, and I don't know the full details of what the negotiations are, but one of the primary issues is certainly wages. And where it gets a little bit hairy is that, you know, the union is saying that Kaiser is offering well below market wages, and that's causing widespread staffing issues because it doesn't make Kaiser a very competitive employer on the hiring market. So there's not enough staffing to maintain safe levels and to provide proper medical care to patients. Patients are having to wait months for medical care, and workers themselves are becoming burnt out with the workload. But on the other side of things, Kaiser is saying, no, actually, we offer above market wages. Kaiser said that they have a quote unquote philosophy of offering 10% above market in its wages. Kaiser didn't offer like what their wages are currently or how they have ensured that they're offering 10% above market, and UFCW also didn't provide the current numbers that are being tossed around at the bargaining table. But UFCW has been a part of what's called a coalition of Kaiser unions, which is a group of local Kaiser workers represented by local unions across the nation And UFCW is, you know, currently trying to step out of the coalition so that they can bargain locally. But the Nationwide Coalition is working on their own contract, which would cover all of the Kaiser workers that are represented by local unions that are a part of this coalition. And they've said that Kaiser is offering for the Northwest what is about a 2% annual raise in wages. And they say this is not enough to compete with rising cost of living or what the market level is right now to maintain staffing. So that's definitely one of their primary concerns. I'm not really aware of what some of their other concerns they might have are in bargaining right now, but I know that's kind of their primary focus at the moment.
I think you also mentioned staffing issues, understaffing. I guess those kind of play in together.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the reasons, you know, aside from obviously cost of living and wanting to make sure these workers are being compensated well, it's also definitely contributing to these understaffing conditions that are super prominent in pretty much every healthcare sphere in the U.S. right now. And because there's not what, you know, these workers say is an appropriate amount of staffing, whether, and this is not an issue that's isolated to the pharmacy sphere, this is an issue that's kind of taken over every sphere of healthcare right now. Because understaffing is such a large problem, you're seeing these really long wait times for patients to receive medical care. You're also seeing a lot of workers burn out, leave the industry, or go to different health systems that are offering better wages and have better staffing levels. And that's one of the main issues that UFCW has pointed to, is that workers at Kaiser don't really have to stay with Kaiser. The wages are not high enough for them to be incentivized to stay with the company, so they're going elsewhere. And that's definitely contributing to these understaffing issues that they're seeing, which just makes it a not great work environment if you're also burnout because you're handling more than you're intended to handle because your company is not able to hire or is not choosing to hire enough staff.
Well, Kaiser is also facing strike authorizations from other bargaining units within the company. What can you tell me about how that plays in?
Yeah, definitely. So since UFCW has historically been a part of this coalition, but is, you know, requesting to leave so that they can bargain their own separate contract, you know, they don't directly factor in, but definitely Kaiser is feeling the pressure on all fronts here at a national level, because not only are UFCW Local 555 here in the Portland area getting ready to strike, but also their nationwide bargaining unit that represents workers in Hawaii, California, Washington, Colorado, DC, Maryland, and Virginia. And there's also another bargaining unit in Portland through SEIU that are all also getting ready to strike. And their strike would be around the same time. It would be between October 4th and October 7th. And it's also an unfair labor practice strike for a lot of the same issues that UFCW Local 555 has cited. So Kaiser is feeling this pressure on a local level, but, you know, whether they are able to avert this strike or not, they do also have this impending strike that's going to hit them. And in Oregon, SEIU, I think, handles around 4,800 Kaiser workers who'd be prepared to go on strike around the same time and overlapping with this UFCW strike as well.
What are the takeaways that you hope listeners and readers get from this story?
Yeah, I think one of the main takeaways that the union really wanted to stress is that because this is a healthcare strike, they're not expecting community members to defer medical care. This is not a situation where they're saying, don't cross the picket line, choose to take your you know, customer business elsewhere. Kaiser is particular in the way it's set up that a lot of their patients don't necessarily have the choice to get the prescriptions from an outside pharmacy. And so UFCW has made it very clear that patients should not put off getting their prescriptions or getting any other kind of medical care from Kaiser because there's a strike going on. But certainly I imagine they would look for support, and they haven't announced any picket lines yet, but if they do have picket lines show up, I'm sure they would be, you know, welcoming support from the community to be out there on the picket line to voice their concern around these issues with Kaiser if you're a patient or not, and to generally be aware that this is not an issue of healthcare professionals wanting to endanger patients, but rather the healthcare industry in this particular company not creating the best environment for workers to be able to best care for patients.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find a copy for themselves?
Yeah, to read more about this story, you can go to streetroots.org, or you can also pick up a print copy from one of Streetroots vendors.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
No, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being with us. I've been speaking with Aurora Biggers, a freelancer with Street Roots, about her new article. It's called KP to Outsource Union Work During Pending Pharmacy Strike. UCFW pharmacy workers filed numerous unfair labor practice claims against the healthcare giant since 2021, await a new contract. That article is out in the print edition of Street Roots this week. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBU News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings. It's KBU's fall membership drive, Fresh Off the Vine. Help support our homegrown radio reporting with a donation today. KBU.fm/give or text KBU to 44321. Thanks. This is KBU News in Depth. For the past 2 days in Portland, timber industry leaders and Wall Street brokers have met at the World Forestry Center for an annual conference called Who Will Own the Forest? Community-based organizations from across the Pacific Northwest gathered simultaneously, rallying yesterday and holding an alternative conference today. It's called Forests Over Profits. KBU's Barbara Bernstein was at the conference today. Here's some of what she heard.
So my name is Thomas Joseph. I grew up not too far from here. I am enrolled with the Hoopa Valley Tribe, which is located in the Six Rivers National Forest of Northern California. We are forest-dwelling indigenous peoples. Our land has always been a rainforest that has changed dramatically due to deforestation of the redwoods and deforestation of the inland empires as well, forest empires. I am also Shoshone Paiute. My father is an enrolled member of the Lone Pine Shoshone Paiute tribe of what we call Paiute, the land of flowing water. It's known today as Owens Valley, which has been stripped of its water to supply Los Angeles with the ability to be the large city that it is. I grew up on the Clearwater River, which is a contributary to the Columbia River here, on the lands of the Nez Perce. I grew up there. I have a lot of family and friends that are Nimiipuu, and it was a good teaching instructions that they've taught me to also understand their connection to place and the importance of protecting our environment and our lands and our waters. And honoring the reciprocal relationship indigenous peoples have always had with their land. Growing up, being connected to that land, which was not a land of my own, gave me a foundation of understanding that we have that ability. We have that ability to connect to place and how important place really is. And the responsibility that we all carry as indigenous and non-indigenous to protect place, to honor the sacred, and to understand that the importance of that reciprocal relationship that we have with our Mother Earth. And that is one of the reasons why I am so inspired to be here with you all today, because this is a room full of people that are dedicated to protecting the sacred, that have dedicated, I have been on the front lines with many of you. I was very active in the LNG, stopping the LNG pipeline in Southern Oregon. Congratulations, the hard work of everybody in this room and beyond to contributing to that. And so I see you. I know where your hearts lie. I understand that you too now have ancestors buried in these lands. And with that comes a responsibility to be accountable to the lands that you walk on, to the water that you drink, and to the air that you breathe. And to come into Portland and witness the drive, the ambition to call out this dark force for what it is. It's a lie. We understand that colonialism is a root cause of climate change. Science will tell you it's fossil fuel, and it's right. Fossil fuel is creating climate change. But it's based on the foundations of colonialism. It's based on the foundations of white supremacy. It's based on the foundation of capitalism. And so if we are to address climate change at scale, those foundations need to be challenged. And it's not going to take market mechanisms. It's not going to take capitalism that we see that's going on inside the halls of where our research assistants were, or in the halls of the UN. That's just a further continuation of colonialism. And it's led primarily by white men. I mean, who was there this yesterday morning when they had the all women's breakfast? It was like 99% white males walking into that space. And that's the truth. That's what it is. You know, and I've been working with so living in a forested land of my ancestral people in Hoopa and in the Nez Perce lands. But living in Hoopa, I was working for our fiscal department for our tribe, and I seen our first carbon market being introduced to our community. And I was kind of shocked. I was like, that's a lot of money. You know, it was, I think at the time, $38 million. And I was like, that's a lot of money, and it kind of sounds too good to be true. And growing up in a matriarch society, in a matriarch household, I'm one of 10 children, I have 5 sisters, so it's a little intense. You know, you take this information and you speak to the matriarchs of the community, and they told me if it's too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. So dig into it. My brother is a linguistics for our tribe, trying to revitalize our language. We have a few fluent speakers, but he's doing a great job with bringing that language back. And so I was asking him, how would you translate this? And he's all, translate what? How do you translate the sequestration of carbon for the benefit of a corporation or an individual? How does that, how, and he's like, you can do a direct translation, which would probably be about 2 to 3 pages. But in reality, it doesn't translate. Because our indigenous values and our indigenous teachings tell us that you can't commodify your Mother Earth in this manner. That you can't take something for the benefit of one. That you can't take something to offset or to harm another people or another community for your personal gain. And so that really hit me. Because knowing the history of American Indians and the policies of the U.S. government, the talking directly about the Indian Relocation Act, is where they came into our communities and they stripped our communities of our teachers, of our doctors, of our medicine leaders, of our children, and they put them in these cities. And when they were relocated into these cities, they were relocated into the impoverished parts of the communities, where you find cement factories, oil refineries, plastic factories, and that those communities are now experiencing high levels of asthma, cancer, low life expectancy. That's where our indigenous people live when if they're not living on their ancestral lands. That's where they've been relocated to. And so now you have a corporation that is asking us to offset their pollution so that they can continue business as usual. That they can continue to emit their emissions and continue to cause harm to our tribal members that are near their factories. And so our people wouldn't stand for it. Our people said, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. We're not going to allow our trees to offset you so you can continue to harm not only our indigenous community that lives near your refineries, but other people of color as well. This is not the first time that we've endured trickery, that we've endured what I call trickets, or, you know, back in the day when they were trying to take our land, they would say, oh, here you can have this, and it's just a little something shiny, and we're like, oh, what a fool, he thinks he's gonna own the land, and he's gonna give me this shiny item, you know? And they're thinking, oh, what a fool, I'm gonna give him this shiny item, and I'm gonna own all this land. Because that was a conflict of understanding, because we didn't think that one can own the land. And this is a similar scenario. And we see as carbon markets is a continuation of that. It's a similar scenario. So the indigenous people in the room, I focus on taking a lot of these carbon market trainings to indigenous peoples because they're the ones that are being targeted. It's the indigenous lands, like my colleague was saying, 80% of the world's biodiversity is in the tenure of indigenous peoples, yet they're a small percentage. And so for the global north to continue their reign as the global north, as these empires, they need access to those biodiversities. And so they're targeting those indigenous communities with projects like forest offsets, nature-based solutions, 30 by 30, because they need to access that unceded indigenous lands. And if you look into Canada, or actually anywhere else in the globe, even here within the United States, they will take that land by all means necessary, even by military might, as we see with the Wet'suwet'en, as we see with what's going on in Mexico with the indigenous people and the expansion of their railway system, as we see in Brazil and Peru and Ecuador and in South and Central America when we're talking about the Amazon, that these forest-dwelling indigenous peoples are being removed from their land because of a contract that they signed for carbon and forest offset projects. And it's tied to a global market. We can see that the commencement of the Kyoto Agreement, which was the foundation for the Paris Climate Agreement, where the world needs to reduce emissions so that we don't reach 1.5 or beyond. You hear EJ communities throughout the globe, 1.5, stay alive. 1.5 is devastational to indigenous peoples. It is not low enough. We will still experience grave harm from climate change at 1.5. Anything beyond is genocidal. And anything beyond that is genocidal for all of us, for all of humanity. This is a real threat. We are experiencing it now. We have seen it in our past. You have lived on these lands long enough to understand that it is a completely different world than what you grew up in, that these lands have changed dramatically, and they will continue to change. Where do you line with your relationship to place, with your responsibility to the sacred? We heard yesterday from our grandmothers that it's the indigenous peoples that are putting their literally life on the line to protect what is left. These indigenous peoples understand that reciprocal relationship. This is not their first go around with colonialism. This is not their first go around with losing all of what they have for the defense of protecting the sacred, the sacredness of their lands, of their air, of their water, and of their families. So, if we look at the United Nations as a mechanism to address climate change, to protect us from 1.5, we need to look at their solutions, or their so-called solutions. What are they doing to reduce emissions at source? Nothing. What are they doing to create a smokescreen, or a promise, or a sense of hope to civil society to make them think that they're addressing climate change? They're creating market mechanisms. They're creating offset projects. They're creating a vast array of false solutions that we can find highly funded through the so-called climate bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is allocating billions of dollars to capture carbon out of the air with CCS, carbon capture and storage, or even with DAX, direct air capture. So these are the methods that they're using. And we wonder, like, oh, that's awesome. Civil society thinks that's great. Yes, let's capture that carbon. But in fact, they're not capturing the carbon. None of those techno fixes are reaching their goals or standards. They know that. They don't need to. All they need to do is create a false hope and continue business as usual. Continue to reap the money that is being poured into these false solutions by your tax dollars. Continue to reap the money of continuing business as usual, as continuing to drill, continuing to pump oil, continuing to burn oil. If you look at carbon capture and storage, it's a little device they're going to put on top of a refinery to capture the carbon. The carbon is harmful to our Mother Earth, but what about all of the other materials and poisons that are being released into the air that's not carbon, that's causing that asthma, that's causing that harm to those BIPOC communities? That's not being captured. Yet so that now they can increase their burning of fossil fuel because they're so-called capturing it. What do they do after they capture it? They put it into pipelines, they liquefy it, and they send it back out to fracking zones so they can pump for more oil. These are the solutions our governments are coming up with. This is the solution to keeping us at 1.5 stay alive. So if we want to create real solutions to climate change, if we want to make sure that we stay alive, we need to reduce emissions at source. We need to keep fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to end our government's desire to use market mechanisms and capitalism to address climate change.
You've been hearing sounds from the Forests Over Profits Counter Conference in Portland today. That was Thomas Joseph from the Indigenous Environmental Network. Our thanks to Barbara Bernstein for gathering the audio. Tune into her program, Locus Focus, every Monday from 10 to 11 a.m. for fantastic environmental coverage. This has been KBOO News In Depth. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. Thanks for being with us.
KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we are in the middle of our fall membership drive. Help us meet our $55,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's organic, free-range, and independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting the word KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214.